Side 5.
It is I who am asking you, mademoiselle.
She sighed, was lost a minute in thought. Then, as though rousing herself, she said,
Those words had a meaning, monsieur, but not one that I can tell you. I can only give you my solemn word of honour that I had never set eyes on this man Ratchet in my life until I saw him on this train.
And you refuse to explain those words?
Yes, if you like to put it that way, I refuse. They had to do with a task I had undertaken.
Oh, a task that is now ended?
What do you mean?
It is ended, is it not?
Well, why should you think so?
Listen, mademoiselle, I will recall to you another incident. There was a delay to the train on the day we were to reach Stamboul. You are very agitated, mademoiselle. You, so calm, so self-controlled, huh? You lost that calm.
Well, I did not want to miss my connection.
So you said. But, mademoiselle, the Orient Express leaves Stamboul every day of the week. Even if you had missed a connection, it would only have been a matter of 24 hours' delay.
Miss Debenham, for the first time, showed signs of losing her temper.
You do not seem to realize that one may have friends awaiting one's arrival in London, and that a day's delay upsets arrangements and causes a lot of annoyance.
Ah, it is like that. There are friends awaiting your arrival. You do not want to cause them inconvenience?
Naturally.
And yet it is curious.
Well, what is curious?
On this train, again, we have a delay. And this time a more serious delay, since there is no possibility of sending a telegram to your friends or of getting them on the long distance?
The telephone, you mean?
Ah, yes, the portmanteau call, as you say in England.
Mary Debenham smiled a little in spite of herself.
Trunk call,
she corrected.
Yes, as you say, it is extremely annoying not to be able to get any word through, either by telephone or telegraph.
And yet, mademoiselle, this time, your manner is quite different. You no longer betray the impatience. You are calm and philosophical. Hmm?
Mary Debenham flushed and bit her lip. She no longer felt inclined to smile.
You do not answer, mademoiselle?
I'm sorry, I did not know there was anything to answer.
The explanation of your change of attitude, mademoiselle.
Well, don't you think that you're making rather a fuss about nothing, Monsieur Poirot?
Poirot spread out his hands in an apologetic gesture.
It is perhaps a fault with us detectives. We expect the behaviour to be always consistent. We do not allow for changes of mood.
Mary Debenham made no reply.
You know Colonel Arbuthnot well, mademoiselle?
He fancied that she was relieved by the change of subject.
I met him for the first time on this journey.
Ah, and have you any reason to suspect that he may have known this man Ratchet?
She shook her head decisively.
Oh, no, I'm quite sure he didn't.
Why are you sure?
Well, by the way he spoke.
And yet, mademoiselle, we found a pipe cleaner on the floor of the dead man's compartment. And Colonel Arbuthnot is the only man on the train who smokes a pipe?
He watched her narrowly, but she displayed neither surprise nor emotion. Merely said,
Nonsense. It's absurd. Colonel Arbuthnot is the last man in the world to be mixed up in a crime, especially a theatrical kind of crime like this.
It was so much what Poirot himself thought that he found himself on the point of agreeing with her. He said instead,
I must remind you that you do not know him very well, mademoiselle.
She shrugged her shoulders.
Well, I know the type well enough.
He said very gently,
You still refuse to tell me the meaning of those words, when it's behind us?
She said coldly,
I have nothing more to say.
Oh, well, it does not matter,
said Hercule Poirot.
I shall find out.
He bowed and left the compartment, closing the door behind him.
Was that wise, my friend?
Asked Monsieur Bouc.
You have put her on her guard, eh? And through her you have put the colonel on his guard also. Mon ami, if you wish to catch a rabbit, you put a ferret into the hole. And if the rabbit is there, he runs. That is all I have done.
They entered the compartment of Hildegard Schmidt. The woman was standing in readiness, her face respectful but unemotional. Poirot took a quick glance through the contents of the small case on the seat. Then he motioned to the attendant to get down the bigger suitcase from the rack.
"The keys?" he said.
"It is not locked, monsieur."
Poirot undid the hasps and lifted the lid.
"Aha!"
he said, and turning to Monsieur Bouc, "You remember what I said?
Look here a little moment, hein?"
On top of the suitcase was a hastily rolled-up brown Wagon Lee uniform. The stolidity of the German woman underwent a sudden change.
"Ah!" she cried. "That is not mine. I did not put it there. I have never looked in that case since we left Stamboul. Indeed, indeed, it is true."
She looked from one to another pleadingly. Poirot took her gently by the arm and soothed her.
"No, no, no. All is well. We believe you. Don't be agitated. I am as sure you did not hide the uniform there as I am sure that you are a good cook. See, you are a good cook, are you not?"
Bewildered, the woman smiled in spite of herself.
"Yes, indeed. All my ladies have said so.
She stopped, her mouth open, looking frightened again.
"No, no, no," said Poirot. "I assure you all is well. See, I will tell you how this happened. This man, the man you saw in Wagon Lee uniform, comes out of the dead man's compartment, huh? He collides with you. Now that is bad luck for him. He has hoped that no one will see him. What to do next? He must get rid of his uniform. It is now not a safeguard, but a danger."
His glance went to Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine, who were listening attentively.
"There is the snow, you see. The snow which confuses all his plans. Where can he hide these clothes, eh? All the compartments are full? No. He passes one where the door is open and shows it to be unoccupied. It must be the one belonging to the woman with whom he has just collided. He slips in, removes the uniform, and jams it hurriedly into a suitcase on the rack. It may be some time before it is discovered."
"And then?"
said Monsieur Bouc.
"Well, that we must discuss,"
said Poirot with a warning glance. He held up the tunic. A button, the third down, was missing. Poirot slipped his hand into the pocket and took out a conductor's pass key, used to unlock the doors of the compartments.
"Here is the explanation of how our man was able to pass through locked doors," said Monsieur Bouc. "Your questions to Mrs. Hubbard were unnecessary. Locked or not locked, the man could easily get through the communicating door. After all, if a Wagon Lee uniform, why not a Wagon Lee key?"
"Why not, indeed?" said Poirot.
"Well, we might have known it, really. You remember Michel said that the door into the corridor of Mrs. Hubbard's compartment was locked when he came in to answer her to her bell.
That is so, monsieur," said the conductor. "That is why I thought the lady must have been dreaming."
"Yeah, but now it is easy," continued Monsieur Bouc. "Doubtless he meant to relock the communicating door also, but perhaps he heard some movement from the bed, and it startled him."
"We have now," said Poirot, "only to find the scarlet kimono."
True. And these last two compartments are occupied by men.
But we will search all the same."
"Oh, assuredly. Besides, I remember what you said,
Hector McQueen acquiesced willingly in the search.
"Well, I'd just as soon you did," he said with a rueful smile. "I feel I'm just definitely the most suspicious character on the train. You've only got to find a will in which the old man left me all his money, and that'll just about fix things."
Monsieur Bouc bent a suspicious glance upon him.
"Well, that's just my fun,"
said McQueen hastily.
"He'd never have left me a cent, really. No, I was just useful to him, you know, languages and so on.
You're up to be done down, you know, if you don't speak anything but good American. I'm no linguist myself, but I know what I call shopping and hotel snappy bits in French and German and Italian."
His voice was a little louder than usual. It was as though he was slightly uneasy at the search, in spite of his willingness. Poirot emerged.
"Nothing," he said. "Not even a compromising bequest."
McQueen sighed. "Well, that's a load off my mind," he said humorously.
They moved on to the last compartment. The examination of the luggage of the big Italian and of the valet yielded no result. The three men stood at the end of the coach looking at each other.
Well, what next? Asked Monsieur Bouc.
Well, we will go back to the dining car, said Poirot. We know now all that we can know. Where are the evidence of the passengers, the evidence of their baggage, the evidence of our eyes. We can expect no further help. It must be our part now to use our brains.
He felt in his pocket for his cigarette case. It was empty.
I will join you in a moment, he said. I shall need the cigarettes. Ah, this is a very difficult and very curious affair. Who wore that scarlet kimono, eh? Where is it now? Oh, I wish I knew. There is something in this case, some factor that escapes me. It is difficult because it has been made difficult, but we will discuss it. Pardon me a moment.
He went hurriedly along the corridor to his own compartments. He had, he knew, a further supply of cigarettes in one of his valises. He got it down and snapped back the lock. Then he sat back on his heels and stared. Neatly folded on the top of the case was a thin scarlet silk kimono embroidered with dragons.
So, he murmured, it is like that, eh? A defiance. Very well. I take it up.
Part 3. Hercule Poirot sits back and thinks. Chapter 1. Which of them? Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine were talking together when Poirot entered the dining car. Monsieur Bouc was looking depressed.
Oh, le voilà,
said the latter when he saw Poirot. And then he added, as his friend sat down,
If you solve this case, mon cher, I shall indeed believe in miracles.
Oh, it worries you, this case?
Oh, naturally it worries me. I cannot make head or tail of it.
I agree, said the doctor. He looked at Poirot with interest. To be frank, he said, I cannot see what you are going to do next.
No,
said Poirot thoughtfully. He took out his cigarette case and lit one of his tiny cigarettes. His eyes were dreamy.
That, to me, is the interest of this case, he said. We are cut off from all the normal routes of procedure. Are these people whose evidence we have taken speaking the truth or lying? No, we have no means of finding out except such means as we can devise ourselves. It is an exercise, this, of the brain.
That is all very fine, said Monsieur Bouc. But what have you to go upon?
Well, I told you just now, we have the evidence of the passengers and the evidence of our own eyes.
Pretty evidence, that of the passengers. It told us just nothing at all.
Poirot shook his head.
I do not agree, my friend.
The evidence of the passengers gave us several points of interest.
Indeed, said Monsieur Bouc skeptically. I did not observe it.
Ah, but that is because you did not listen.
Well, tell me, what did I miss? I will just take one instance. The first evidence we heard, that of the young McQueen. He uttered, to my mind, one very significant phrase.
What, about the letters?
No, not about the letters. As far as I can remember, his words were, we travelled about, Monsieur Ratchet wanted to see the world. He was hampered by knowing no languages. I acted more as a courier than a secretary.
He looked from the doctor's face to that of Monsieur Bouc.
What? You still do not see? Now that is inexcusable, for you had a second chance again just now when he said, you're apt to be done down if you speak nothing but good American.
You mean...
Monsieur Bouc still looked puzzled.
Ah, it is that you want it given to you in words of one syllable? Well, here it is. Monsieur Ratchet spoke no French. Ha-ha! Yet, when the conductor came in to answer to his bell last night, it was a voice speaking in French that told him that it was a mistake and that he was not wanted. It was, moreover, a perfectly idiomatic phrase that was used. Not one that a man knowing only a few words of French would have selected. Ce n'est rien, je me suis trompé.
It is true,
cried Constantine excitedly.
We should have seen that. I remember your laying stress on the words when you repeated them to us. Now I understand your reluctance to rely upon the evidence of the dented watch. Already, at 1:23, Ratchet was dead.
Ah, and it was his murderer speaking,
finished Monsieur Bouc impressively. Poirot raised a deprecating hand.
Let us not go too fast.
And do not let us assume more than we actually know. It is safe, I think, to say that at that time, 1:23, some other person was in Ratchet's compartment, and that that person was either French or could speak the French language fluently.
You are very cautious, mon vieux.
Well, one should advance only a step at a time. We have no actual evidence that Ratchet was dead at that time.
But there is the cry that awakened you.
Yes, that is true.
Well, in one way, said Monsieur Bouc thoughtfully, this discovery does not affect things very much. You heard someone moving about next door. That someone was not Ratchet, but the other man. Doubtless he is washing blood from his hands, clearing up after the crime, burning the incriminating letter. And then he waits till all is still, and when he thinks it is safe and the coast is clear, he locks and chains Ratchet's door on the inside, unlocks the communicating door through into Mrs. Hubbard's compartment, and slips out that way. In fact, it is exactly as we thought, with the difference that Ratchet was killed about 30 minutes earlier, and the watch put on to 1:15 to create an alibi.
Well, but not such a famous alibi, said Poirot.
The hands of the watch pointed to 1:15, the exact time when the intruder actually left the scene of the crime.
True, said Monsieur Bouc, a little confused.
But what, then, does the watch convey to you?
If the hands were altered, I say if, then the time at which they were set must have a significance, huh?
The natural reaction would be to suspect anyone who had a reliable alibi for the time indicated, in this case 1:15.
Yes, yes, said the doctor. That reasoning is good. We must also pay a little attention to the time the intruder entered the compartment. When had he an opportunity of doing so? Unless we are to assume the complicity of the real conductor, there was only one time when he could have done so. During the time the train stopped at Vinkovki. After the train left Vinkovki, the conductor was sitting facing the corridor, and whereas any one of the passengers would pay little attention to a wagonly attendant, the one person who would notice an impostor would be the real conductor. But during the halt at Vinkovki, the conductor is out on the platform. The coast is clear.
Oh, and by our former reasoning, it must be one of the passengers, said Monsieur Bouc.
Oh, we come back to where we were.
Which of them,
Poirot smiled.
I have made a list, he said.
If you like to see it, it will perhaps refresh your memory.
The doctor and Monsieur Bouc pored over the list together. It was written out neatly, in a methodical manner, in the order in which the passengers had been interviewed. Hector McQueen, American subject, berth number 6, second class. Motive, possibly arising out of association with dead man. Alibi, from midnight to 2 a.m., in brackets, midnight to 1:30, vouched for by Colonel Arbuthnot, and 1:15 to 2, vouched for by conductor, end brackets. Evidence against him? None. Circumstances? None. Conductor, Pierre Michel, French subject. Motive? None. Alibi? From midnight to 2 a.m. In brackets seen by HP in corridor at same time as voice spoke from Ratchet's compartment at 12:37. From 1 a.m. to 1:16, vouched for by other two conductors. End brackets. Evidence against him? None. Suspicious circumstances.
The Wagon Lee uniform found is a point in his favour, since it seems to have been intended to throw suspicion on him. Edward Masterman, English subject, berth number 4, second class. Motive? Possibly arising out of connection with deceased, whose valet he was. Alibi? From midnight to 2 a.m., in brackets, vouched for by Antonio Foscarelli, end brackets. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances? None. Except that he is the only man the right height or size to have worn the Wagon Lee uniform. On the other hand, it is unlikely that he speaks French well. Mrs. Hubbard. American subject. Berth number 3. First class. Motive? None. Alibi? From midnight to 2 a.m.? None. Evidence against her or suspicious circumstances? Story of man in her compartment is substantiated by the evidence of the woman Schmidt. Greta Olsen. Swedish subject. Berth number 10. Second class. Motive? None. Alibi? From midnight to 2 a.m. in brackets vouched for by Mary Debenham. End brackets. Note. Was last to see Ratchet alive. Princess Dragomirov. Naturalized French subject. Motive? Was intimately acquainted with Armstrong family and godmother to Sonia Armstrong. Alibi? From midnight to 2 a.m. in brackets vouched for by conductor and maid. End brackets. Evidence against her or suspicious circumstances? None. Count Andrenyi. Hungarian subject. Diplomatic passport. Berth number 13, first class. Motive? None. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., in brackets, vouched for by conductor. This does not cover period from 1 to 1.15, end brackets. Countess Andrenyi, as above. Berth number 12, motive, none. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., took Trionel and slept, in brackets, vouched for by husband. Trionel bottle in her cupboard, end brackets. Colonel Arbuthnot, British subject. Berth number 15, first class. Motive? None. Alibi? Midnight to 2 a.m. Talked with McQueen till 1.30. Went to own compartment and did not leave it. In brackets, substantiated by McQueen and conductor. End brackets. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances? Pipe cleaner. Cyrus Hardman. American subject. Berth number 16, second class. Motive? None known. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., did not leave compartment, in brackets, substantiated by McQueen and conductor, end brackets. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances? None. Antonio Foscarelli, American subject, in brackets, Italian birth. Berth number 5, second class. Motive, none known. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m., in brackets, vouched for by Edward Masterman, end brackets. Evidence against him or suspicious circumstances? None. Except that weapon used might be said to suit his temperament. In brackets, vide Monsieur Bouc. In brackets. Mary Debenham. British subject, berth number 11, second class. Motive? None. Alibi? Midnight to 2 a.m. In brackets, vouched for by Greta Olsen. Evidence against her or suspicious circumstances? Conversation overheard by H.P., and her refusal to explain same. Hildegard Schmidt, German subject. Berth number 8, second class. Motive, none. Alibi, midnight to 2 a.m. In brackets, vouched for by conductor and her mistress. End brackets. Went to bed. Was aroused by conductor at 12:38 approximately and went to mistress. Note, the evidence of the passengers is supported by the statement of the conductor that no one entered or left Mr. Ratchet's compartment between the hours of midnight to 1 o'clock. In brackets, when he himself went into the next coach, end brackets, and from 1:15 to 2 o'clock. That document, you understand, said Poirot, is a mere précis of the evidence we heard, arranged that way for convenience. With a grimace, Monsieur Bouc handed it back.
It is not illuminating, he said. Well, perhaps you may find this more to your taste, said Poirot with a slight smile as he handed him a second sheet of paper.
Chapter 2. On the paper was written, Things Needing Explanation. 1. The handkerchief marked with the initial H. Whose is it? 2. The pipe cleaner. Was it dropped by Colonel Arbuthnot or by someone else? 3. Who wore the scarlet kimono? 4. Who was the man or woman masquerading in Wagon Lee uniform? 5. Why do the hands of the watch point to 1:15? 6. Was the murder committed at that time? 7. Was it earlier? 8. Was it later? 9. Can we be sure that Ratchet was stabbed by more than one person? 10. What other explanation of his wounds can there be?
"Well, let us see what we can do," said Monsieur Bouc, brightening a little at this challenge to his wits. "Now, the handkerchief to begin with. Let us, by all means, be orderly and methodical."
"Assuredly,"
said Poirot, nodding his head in a satisfied fashion. Monsieur Bouc continued somewhat didactically.
"Now, the initial H is connected with three people. Mrs. Hubbard, Miss Debenham, whose second name is Hermione, and the maid Hildegard Schmidt."
"Ah, and of those three?"
"Well, it is difficult to say, but I think I should vote for Miss Debenham. For all one knows, she may be called by her second name and not her first. Also, there is already some suspicion attaching to her. That conversation you overheard, mon cher, was certainly a little curious, and so is her refusal to explain it."
"Well, as for me, I plump for the American," said Dr. Constantine. "It is a very expensive handkerchief, that, and Americans, as all the world knows, do not take care what they pay."
"So, you both eliminate the maid?" asked Poirot.
"Oh, yes. As she herself said, it is the handkerchief of a member of the upper classes."
"And the second question, the pipe cleaner. Did Colonel Arbuthnot drop it, or somebody else?"
"No, that is more difficult. The English, they do not stab. You are right there. Now, I incline to the view that someone else dropped the pipe cleaner and did so to incriminate the long-legged Englishman."
"As you said, Monsieur Poirot," put in the doctor, "two clues is too much carelessness. I agree with Monsieur Bouc. The handkerchief was a genuine oversight. Hence, no one will admit that it is theirs. The pipe cleaner is a faked one. In support of that theory, you notice that Colonel Arbuthnot shows no embarrassment and admits freely to smoking a pipe and using that type of cleaner."
"You reason well," said Poirot.
Question number 3. Who wore the scarlet kimono?
Went on Monsieur Bouc.
"As to that, I will confess I have not the slightest idea. Have you any views on the subject, Dr. Constantine?"
"None."
"Then we confess ourselves beaten there. The next question has, at any rate, possibilities. Who was the man or woman masquerading in Wagon Lee uniform? Well, one can say with certainty a number of people whom it could not be. Hardman, Colonel Arbuthnot, Foscarelli, Count Andreny, and Hector McQueen are too tall. Mrs. Hubbard, Hildegard Schmidt, and Greta Olsen, too broad. And that leaves the valet, Miss Debenham, Princess Dragomirov, and Countess Adreny, and none of them sounds likely. Greta Olsen, in one case, and Antonio Foscarelli, in the other, both swear that Miss Debenham and the valet never left the compartment. Hildegard Schmidt swears to the princess being in hers, and Count Adreny has told us that his wife took a sleeping draught. Therefore, it seems impossible that it can be anybody, which is absurd.
As our old friend Euclid says, murmured Poirot.
It must be one of those four, said Dr. Constantine, unless it is someone from outside who has found a hiding place, and that, we agreed, was impossible.
Number 5, why do the hands of the broken watch point to 1:15? Now, I can see two explanations in that. Either it was done by the murderer to establish an alibi, and afterwards he was prevented from leaving the compartment when he meant to do so by hearing people moving about, or else... wait, I have an idea coming.
The other two waited respectfully while Monsieur Bouc struggled in mental agony.
I have it.
he said at last.
It was not the Wagon Lee murderer who tampered with the watch. It was the person we have called the second murderer, the left-handed person. In other words, the woman in the scarlet kimono. She arrives later and moves back the hands of the watch in order to make an alibi for herself.
Oh, bravo, said Dr. Constantine. It is well imagined that.
In fact, said Poirot, she stabbed him in the dark, not realizing that he was dead already, but somehow deduced that he had a watch in his pajama pocket, took it out, put back the hands blindly, and gave it the requisite dent.
Monsieur Bouc looked at him coldly.
Well, have you anything better to suggest yourself?
He asked.
At the moment, no,
admitted Poirot.
All the same, he went on, I do not think you have, either of you, appreciated the most interesting point about that watch.
Well, does question number 6 deal with it? Asked the doctor.
To that question, was the murder committed at that time, 1:15? I answer no.
I agree, said Monsieur Bouc.
Was it earlier? Is the next question.
I say yes.
You too, doctor?
The doctor nodded.
Yes, but the question, was it later, can also be answered in the affirmative. I agree with your theory, Monsieur Bouc, and so I think does Monsieur Poirot, although he does not wish to commit himself. The first murderer came earlier than 1:15. The second murderer came after 1:15. And as regards the question of left-handedness, ought we not to take steps to ascertain which of the passengers is left-handed?
Well, I have not completely neglected that point, said Poirot. You may have noticed that I made each passenger write either a signature or an address. Now, that is not conclusive, because some people do certain actions with the right hand and others with the left. Some write right-handed, but play golf left-handed.
Still, it is something. Every person questioned took the pen in their right hand, with the exception of Princess Dragomirov, who refused to write.
Princess Dragomirov? Impossible, said Monsieur Bouc.
I doubt if she would have had the strength to inflict that particular left-handed blow, said Dr. Constantine dubiously. That particular wound had been inflicted with considerable force.
More force than a woman could use?
Well, no, I would not say that, but I think more force than an elderly woman could display, and Princess Dragomirov's physique is particularly frail.
Well, it might be a question of the influence of mind over body, said Poirot.
Princess Dragomirov has great personality and immense willpower, but let us pass from that for the moment. To questions numbers 9 and 10. Can we be sure that Ratchet was stabbed by more than one person, and what other explanation of the wounds can there be?
In my opinion, medically speaking, there can be no other explanation of those wounds. To suggest that one man struck first feebly, and then with violence, first with the right hand and then with the left, and after an interval of perhaps half an hour inflicted fresh wounds on a dead body, well, no, it does not make sense.
No, said Poirot, it does not make sense. And you think that two murderers do make sense?
Well, as you yourself have said, what other explanation can there be?
Poirot stared straight ahead of him.
That is what I ask myself, he said. That is what I never cease to ask myself.
He leaned back in his seat.
From now on, it is all here.
He tapped himself on the forehead.
We have thrashed it all out. The facts are all in front of us, neatly arranged with order and method. The passengers have sat here one by one, giving their evidence. We know all that can be known from outside.
He gave an affectionate smile at Monsieur Bouc.
It has been a little joke between us, has it not, this business of sitting back and thinking out the truth? Well, I am about to put my theory into practice, here before your eyes. Now you two must do the same. Let us all three close our eyes and think. One or more of those passengers killed Ratchet?
which of them?
Chapter 3. Certain Suggestive Points. It was quite a quarter of an hour before anyone spoke. Monsieur Bouc and Dr. Constantine had started by trying to obey Poirot's instructions. They had endeavoured to see through a maze of conflicting particulars to a clear and outstanding solution. Monsieur Bouc's thoughts had run something as follows.
Assuredly, I must think. But as far as that goes, I have already thought. Poirot obviously thinks this English girl is mixed up in the matter. I cannot help feeling that that is most unlikely. The English are extremely cold. Perhaps it is because they have no figures. But that is not the point. No. I suppose the English valet is not lying when he said the other never left the compartment. But why should he? It is not easy to bribe the English. They are so unapproachable. The whole thing is most unfortunate. I wonder when we shall get out of this. There must be some rescue work in progress. They are so slow in these countries. It is hours before anyone thinks of doing anything. And the police of these countries, they will be most trying to deal with, puffed up with importance, touchy on their dignity. They will make a grand affair of all this. It is not often that such a chance comes their way. It will be in all the newspapers.
And from there on, Monsieur Bouc's thoughts went along a well-worn course which they had already traversed some 100 times. Dr. Constantine's thoughts ran thus.
He is queer, this little man. A genius or a crank? Will he solve this mystery? No, impossible. I can see no way out of it. It is all too confusing. Everyone is lying, perhaps. But even then, that does not help one. If they are all lying, it is just as confusing as if they were all speaking the truth. Odd about those wounds. I cannot understand it. It would be easier to understand if he had been shot. After all, the term gunman must mean that they shoot with a gun. A curious country, America. I should like to go there. It is so progressive. When I get home, I must get hold of Dmitri Zagony. He has been to America. He has all the modern ideas. I wonder what Zia is doing at this moment. If my wife ever finds out.
His thoughts went on to entirely private matters. Hercule Poirot sat very still. One might have thought he was asleep. And then suddenly, after a quarter of an hour's complete immobility, his eyebrows began to move slowly up his forehead. A little sigh escaped him. He murmured beneath his breath.
But after all, why not? And if so? Well, why, if so, that would explain everything?
His eyes opened. They were green, like a cat's. He said softly,
Eh bien, I had thought. And you?
Lost in their reflections, both men started violently.
Well, I have thought also, said Monsieur Bouc, just a shade guiltily. But I have arrived at no conclusion. The elucidation of crime is your métier, not mine, my friend.
I, too, have reflected with great earnestness, said the doctor unblushingly,
recalling his thoughts from certain pornographic details.
I thought of many possible theories, but not one that really satisfies me.
Poirot nodded amiably. His nod seemed to say,
Quite right. That is the proper thing to say. You have given me the cue I expected.
He sat very upright, threw out his chest, caressed his moustache, and spoke in the manner of a practised speaker addressing a public meeting.
My friends, I have reviewed the facts in my mind, and have also gone over to myself the evidence of the passengers with this result. I see, nebulously as yet, a certain explanation that would cover the facts as we know them. It is a very curious explanation, and I cannot be sure as yet that it is a true one. To find out definitely, I shall have to make certain experiments. I would like first to mention certain points which appear to me suggestive. Let us start with a remark made to me by Monsieur Bouc in this very place on the occasion of our first lunch together on the train. He commented on the fact that we were surrounded by people of all classes, of all ages, of all nationalities. Now, that is a fact somewhat rare at this time of year.
The Athens Paris and the Bucharest Paris coaches, for instance, are almost empty. Remember also one passenger who failed to turn up. It is, I think, significant. Then there are some minor points that strike me as suggestive. For instance, the position of Mrs. Abel's sponge bag, the name of Mrs. Armstrong's mother, the detective methods of Monsieur Abman, the suggestion of Monsieur McQueen that Ratchet himself destroyed the child not be found, Princess Dragomirov's Christian name, and a grease spot on a Hungarian passport. The two men stared at him. Do they suggest anything to you, those points? Asked Poirot.
Not a thing, said Monsieur Bouc frankly.
And Monsieur le Docteur?
I do not understand in the least of what you are talking.
Monsieur Bouc, meanwhile, seizing upon the one tangible thing his friend had mentioned, was sorting through the passports. With a grunt, he picked up that of Count and Countess Andreny and opened it.
Is this what you mean, this dirty mark?
Yes. It is a fairly fresh grease spot. You notice where it occurs?
At the beginning of the description of the Count's wife. Her Christian name, to be exact. But I confess that I still do not see the point.
I am going to approach it from another angle. Let us go back to the handkerchief found at the scene of the crime. As we have stated not long ago, three people are associated with the letter H. Mrs. Hubbard, Miss Debenham, and the maid, Hildegard Schmidt. Now, let us regard that handkerchief from another point of view. It is, my friends, an extremely expensive handkerchief. An objet de luxe. Handmade. Embroidered in Paris. Now, which of the passengers, apart from the initial, was likely to own such a handkerchief? Not Mrs. Hubbard, a worthy woman with no pretensions to reckless extravagance in dress. And not Miss Debenham? That class of English woman has a dainty linen handkerchief, but not an expensive wisp of cambric, costing perhaps 200 francs. And certainly not a maid. But there are two women on the train who would be likely to own such a handkerchief. Now let us see if we can connect them in any way with the letter H. The two women I refer to are Princess Dragomirov,
Whose Christian name is Natalia,
put in Monsieur Bouc, ironically.
Exactly. And her Christian name, as I said just now, is decidedly suggestive. The other woman is Countess Andreny. And at once, something strikes us.
You?
Well, me, then.
Her Christian name on her passport is disfigured by a blob of grease.
Or just an accident, anyone would say. But consider that Christian name. Elena. Suppose that instead of Elena, it were Helena. Now that capital H could be turned into a capital E, and then run over the small E next to it quite easily, and then a spot of grease dropped to cover up the alteration.
Helena?
Cried Monsieur Bouc.
It is an idea, that.
Certainly it is an idea. I look about for any confirmation, however slight, of my idea, and I find it. One of the luggage labels on the Countess's baggage is slightly damp. It is one that happens to run over the first initial on top of the case. That label has been soaked off and put on again in a different place.
You begin to convince me, said Monsieur Bouc. But the Countess and Brigny, surely...
Now, mon vieux. You must turn yourself round and approach an entirely different angle of the case. How was this murder intended to appear to everybody, eh? Now, do not forget that the snow has upset all the murderer's original plan. Let us imagine, for a little minute, that there is no snow, that the train proceeded on its normal course. What, then, would have happened? The murder, let us say, would still have been discovered, in all probability, at the Italian frontier early this morning. Much of the same evidence would have been given to the Italian police. The threatening letters would have been produced by Monsieur McQueen. Monsieur Adman would have told his story. Mrs. Hubbard would have been eager to tell how a man passed through her compartment. The button would have been found. I imagine that two things only would have been different. The man would have passed through Mrs. Hubbard's compartment just before 1 o'clock, and the Wagonlit uniform would have been found cast off in one of the toilets.
You mean?
I mean that the murder was planned to look like an outside job. The assassin would have been presumed to have left the train at Broad, where the train is timed to arrive at 12:58 in the morning. Somebody would probably have passed a strange Wagonlit conductor in the corridor. The uniform would have been left in a conspicuous place so as to show clearly just how the trick had been played. No suspicion would have been attached to the passengers, and that, my friends, was how the affair was intended to appear to the outside world. But the accident to the train changes everything. Doubtless we have here the reason why the man remained in the compartment with his victim so long. He was waiting for the train to go on. But at last he realized that the train was not going on. Different plans would have to be made. The murderer would now be known to be still on the train.
Yes, 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 said Monsieur Bouc impatiently. I see all that, but where does the handkerchief come in?
I am returning to it by a somewhat circuitous route. To begin with, you must realize that these threatening letters were in the nature of a blind. They might have been lifted bodily out of an indifferently written American crime novel. They are not real. They are, in fact, simply intended for the police. Now, what we have to ask ourselves is, did they deceive Ratchet? On the face of it, the answer seems to be no. His instructions to Hardman seem to point to a definite private enemy, of the identity of whom he was well aware. That is, if we accept Hardman's story as true. But Ratchet certainly received one letter of a very different character, the one containing a reference to the Armstrong baby, a fragment of which we found in his compartment. In case Ratchet had not realized it sooner, this was to make sure that he understood the reason of the threats against his life. That letter, as I have said all along, was not intended to be found. The murderer's first care was to destroy it. This, then, was the second hitch in his plans. The first was the snow. The second was our reconstruction of that fragment. That note being destroyed so carefully can only mean one thing. There must be on the train someone so intimately connected with the Armstrong family that the finding of that note would immediately direct suspicion upon that person. Now, we come to the other two clues that we found. I pass over the pipe cleaner. We have already said a good deal about that. Now let us pass on to the handkerchief. Taken at its simplest, it is a clue which directly incriminates someone whose initial is H. And it was dropped there unwittingly by that person.
Exactly, said Dr. Constantine. She finds out that she has dropped the handkerchief and immediately takes steps to conceal her Christian name.
Ah! How fast you go, huh? You arrive at the conclusion much sooner than I would permit myself to do.
But is there any other alternative?
Certainly there is. Suppose, for instance, that you have committed a crime and wish to cast a suspicion for it on someone else. Well, there is on the train a certain person connected intimately with the Armstrong family. A woman. Suppose, then, that you leave there a handkerchief belonging to that woman. She will be questioned, her connection with the Armstrong family will be brought out, et voila. Motive and an incriminating article of evidence.
But in such a case, objected the doctor, the person indicated being innocent would not take steps to conceal her identity.
Oh, really? That is what you think? That is truly the opinion of the police court. But I know human nature, my friend. And I tell you that, suddenly confronted with the possibility of being tried for murder, the most innocent person will lose their head and do the most absurd things. No, 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 no. The grease spot and the changed label do not prove guilt. No. They only prove that the Countess Andrenier is anxious for some reason to conceal her identity.
What do you think her connection with the Armstrong family can be? She has never been in America, she says.
Exactly. And she speaks broken English, and she has a very foreign appearance, which she exaggerates. But it should not be difficult to guess who she is. I mentioned just now the name of Mrs. Armstrong's mother. It was Linda Arden, and she was a very celebrated actress. Among other things, a Shakespearean actress. Think of As You Like It, The Forest of Arden, and Rosalind. It was there she got the inspiration for her acting name. Linda Arden. The name by which she was known all over the world was not her real name. It may have been Goldenberg. She quite likely had Central European blood in her veins, a strain of Jewish, perhaps. Many nationalities drift to America. Now, I suggest to you, gentlemen, that that young sister of Mrs. Armstrong's, little more than a child at the time of the tragedy, was Helena Goldenberg, the younger daughter of Linda Arden, and she married Count Andrenier when he was an attaché in Washington.
But Princess Dragimirov says that she married an Englishman.
Yeah, whose name she cannot remember. I ask you, my friends, is that really likely? Princess Dragomirov loved Linda Arden, as great ladies do love great artists. She was godmother to one of her daughters. Would she forget so quickly the married name of the other daughter? No, it is not likely. No, I think we can safely say that Princess Dragomirov was lying. She knew Helena was on the train. She had seen her. She realized at once, as soon as she heard who Ratchet really was, that Helena would be suspected. And so, when we question her as to the sister, she promptly lies. Is vague, cannot remember, but thinks Helena married an Englishman. A suggestion as far away from the truth as possible.
One of the restaurant car attendants came through the door at the end and approached them. He addressed Monsieur Bouc.
The dinner, monsieur, shall I serve it? It is ready some little time.
Monsieur Bouc looked at Poirot. The latter nodded.
Oh, by all means, let dinner be served.
The attendant vanished through the doors at the other end. His bell could be heard ringing, and his voice upraised.
Premier service. Le dîner est servi. Premier dîner. First service.
Chapter 4. The Grease Spot on a Hungarian Passport. Poirot shared a table with Monsieur Bouc and the doctor. The company assembled in the restaurant car was a very subdued one. They spoke little. Even the loquacious Mrs. Hubbard was unnaturally quiet. She murmured as she sat,
"Oh, I don't feel as though I've got the heart to eat anything."
And then partook of everything offered her, encouraged by the Swedish lady, who seemed to regard her as a special charge. Before the meal was served, Poirot had caught the chief attendant by the sleeve and murmured something to him. Constantine had a pretty good guess what the instructions had been, as he noticed that the Count and Countess Adrenier were always served last, and that at the end of the meal there was a delay in making out their bill. It therefore came about that the Count and Countess were the last left in the restaurant car. When they rose at length and moved in the direction of the door, Poirot sprang up and followed them.
Pardon, madame, you have dropped your handkerchief, eh?
He was holding out to her the tiny monogrammed square. She took it, glanced at it, then handed it back to him.
You are mistaken, monsieur. That is not my handkerchief.
Oh, not your handkerchief, are you sure?
Perfectly sure, monsieur.
And yet, madame, it has your initial, the initial H.
The Count made a sudden movement. Poirot ignored him. His eyes were fixed on the Countess's face. Looking steadily at him, she replied,
I do not understand, monsieur. My initials are E-A.
I think not. Your name is Helena, not Elena. Helena Goldenberg. the youngest daughter of Linda Arden, Helena Goldenberg, the sister of Mrs. Armstrong.
There was a dead silence for a minute or two. Both the Count and Countess had gone deadly white. Poirot said in a gentler tone, "It is of no use denying. That is the truth, is it not?" The Count burst out furiously.
"I demand, monsieur, by what right you..."
She interrupted him, putting up a small hand towards his mouth.
"No, Rudolph. Let me speak. It is useless to deny what this gentleman says. We had better sit down and talk the matter out." Her voice had changed. It still had the southern richness of tone, but it had become suddenly more clear-cut and incisive. It was, for the first time, a definitely American voice. The Count was silenced. He obeyed the gesture of her hand. They both sat down opposite Poirot.
"Your statement, monsieur, is quite true," said the Countess. "I am Helena Goldenberg, the younger sister of Mrs. Armstrong.
You did not acquaint me with that fact this morning, Madame la Comtesse."
"No.
In fact, all that your husband and you told me was a tissue of lies."
"Monsieur!"
cried the Count angrily.
"Do not be angry, Rudolph. Monsieur Poirot puts the fact rather brutally, but what he says is undeniable."
"Oh, I am glad you admit the facts so freely, madame. Will you now tell me your reasons for so doing, and also for altering your Christian name on your passport?"
"That was my doing entirely," put in the Count.
Helena said quietly, "Surely, Monsieur Poirot, you can guess my reason. Our reason. This man who was killed is the man who murdered my baby niece, who killed my sister, who broke my brother-in-law's heart. Three of the people I loved best and who made up my home. My world."
Her voice rang out passionately. She was a true daughter of that mother, the emotional force of whose acting had moved huge audiences to tears. She went on more quietly.
"Of all the people in the train, I alone had probably the best motive for killing him."
"And you did not kill him, madame?"
"I swear to you, Monsieur Poirot, and my husband knows and will swear also, that much as I may have been tempted to do so, I never lifted a hand against that man."
"I too, gentlemen," said the Count. "I give you my word of honor that last night Helena never left her compartment. She took a sleeping draught, exactly as I said. She is utterly and entirely innocent."
Poirot looked from one to the other of them.
"On my word of honor," repeated the Count.
Poirot shook his head slightly.
"And yet you took it upon yourself to alter the name in the passport?" "Monsieur Poirot," the Count spoke earnestly and passionately, "consider my position. Do you think I could stand a thought of my wife dragged through a sordid police case? She was innocent. I knew it. But what she said was true. Because of her connection with the Armstrong family, she would have been immediately suspected. She would have been questioned, arrested perhaps. Since some evil chance had taken us on the same train as this man Ratchet, there was, I felt sure, but one thing for it. I admit, monsieur, that I lied to you. All, that is, save one thing. My wife never left her compartment last night."
He spoke with an earnestness that it was hard to gainsay.
"Well, I do not say that I disbelieve you, monsieur," said Poirot slowly.
"Your family is, I know, a proud and ancient one. It would be bitter indeed for you to have your wife dragged into an unpleasant police case. With that I can sympathize.
But how, then, do you explain the presence of your wife's handkerchief actually in the dead man's compartment?"
"That handkerchief is not mine, monsieur,"
said the Countess.
"Well, in spite of the initial H?"
"In spite of the initial. I have handkerchiefs not unlike that, but not one that is exactly of that pattern. I know, of course, that I cannot hope to make you believe me, but I assure you that it is so. That handkerchief is not mine."
"It may have been placed there by someone in order to incriminate you?"
She smiled a little.
You are enticing me to admit that, after all, it is mine. No, but indeed, Monsieur Poirot, it isn't.
She spoke with great earnestness.
Then why, if the handkerchief was not yours, did you alter the name in the passport?
The Count answered this.
Because we heard that a handkerchief had been found with the initial H on it.
We talked the matter over together before we came to be interviewed. I pointed out to Helena that if it were seen that her Christian name began with an H, she would immediately be subjected to much more rigorous questioning. And the thing was so simple. To alter Helena to Elena was easily done.
You have, Monsieur le Comte, the makings of a very fine criminal, remarked Poirot dryly. A great natural ingenuity, and an apparently remorseless determination to mislead justice.
Oh, no, no, the girl leaned forward. Monsieur Poirot, he's explained to you how it was. She broke from French into English.
I was scared, absolutely dead scared, you understand? It had been so awful that time, and to have it all raked up again and to be suspected and perhaps thrown into prison, I was just scared stiff, Monsieur Poirot. Can't you understand at all?
Her voice was lovely, deep, rich, and pleading. The voice of the daughter of Linda Arden, the actress. Poirot looked gravely at her.
If I am to believe you, madame, and I do not say that I will not believe you, then you must help me.
Help you?
Yes. The reason for the murder lies in the past, in that tragedy which broke up your home and saddened your young life. Take me back into the past, mademoiselle, that I may find there the link that explains the whole thing.
Well, what can there be to tell you? They're all dead, she repeated mournfully. All dead, all dead. Robert, Sonia, darling, darling Daisy. Oh, she was so sweet, so happy. She had such lovely curls. We were all just crazy about her.
But there was another victim, madame. An indirect victim, you might say.
Poor Suzanne? Oh, yes. I had forgotten about her. The police questioned her. They were convinced that she had something to do with it. Well, perhaps she had, but if so, only innocently. She had, I believe, chatted idly with someone, well, giving information as to the time of Daisy's outings. The poor thing got terribly wrought up. She thought she was being held responsible, and
she shuddered.
She threw herself out of the window. Oh, it was horrible.
She buried her face in her hands.
What nationality was she, madame?
She was French.
What was her last name?
It's absurd. I can't remember. We all called her Suzanne. A pretty laughing girl. She was devoted to Daisy.
She was a nursery maid, was she not?
Yes.
Who was the nurse?
She was a trained hospital nurse. Stengelberg, her name was. She, too, was devoted to Daisy and to my sister.
Now, madame, I want you to think carefully before you answer this question. Have you, since you were on this train, seen anyone that you recognized?
She stared at him.
I? No. No one at all.
What about Princess Dragomirov?
Oh, her! Oh, well, I know her, of course. I thought you meant anyone from, well, from that time.
So I did, madame. Now, think carefully. Some years have passed, remember? The person might have altered their appearance.
Helena pondered deeply. Then she said,
No, I'm sure. There is no one.
You yourself, you were a young girl at the time. Did you have no one to superintend your studies or to look after you?
Oh, yes, I had a dragon, a sort of governess to me and secretary to Sonia combined. She was English, or rather Scotch, a big, red-haired woman.
What was her name?
Miss Freebody.
Uh-huh. Young or old?
Oh, she seemed frightfully old to me. I suppose she couldn't have been more than 40. Suzanne, of course, used to look after my clothes and maid me.
And there were no other inmates of the house?
Only servants.
And you are certain, quite certain, madame, that you have recognized no one on the train?
She replied earnestly, no one at all. End of side 5.